All right. Well, I think we should get started. So I want to welcome all of you. Thank you for being here. What an amazing conference. What an amazing morning to be a part of. My name is Richard Lopez, and I'm part of Dell's diversity and inclusion team. And thank you. I got some fans out there. They're fans of the company. Listen, Dell is excited to be a sponsor of this conference, a conference that's really focused on, you know, advancing, empowering women, giving a message that's impacting you personally, impacting our communities. It's exciting to be a part of that. And this particular topic that we're going to be discussing today is one that is very near and dear to my heart, so finding and engaging male allies. And so on the diversity and inclusion team, I've had the privilege over the last 5 years to lead Dell's Engaging Men initiatives, something that has grown from something that was very small as an idea that has just kind of grown wings of its own. And so you're actually going to hear one of our panelists, Michael, talk about this program called MARC, one that Dell embarked upon 5 years ago with 20 leaders. We brought together 20 leaders from different business units with this idea that if we were able to engage men and get them off the sidelines and into the conversations of driving change for everyone, that we could really impact our culture. And here we are 5 years later. If you fast forward, we've actually had over 15,000 of our team members participate in the same type of workshop that these 20 leaders experienced. And it's made a huge impact on our company. Michael Dell and his leadership team have had an opportunity to participate in this type of workshop where we talk about bias and privilege and things that get in the way of building inclusive work cultures. All of our executives have participated and are participating in this. By the end of this year, we'll reach all of our people managers, you know, 12,000 people managers globally. So this is something, as we talk about, we've got an amazing panel up here. We're very fortunate to have some real thought leaders on why do we need and why do we want male allies? Why is it that that we can leverage the position, the power, the privilege that that the male leaders and companies bring to make the most possible change for all of us to thrive in our careers? So without further ado, I do want to pass it to the moderator of this panel and our thought leader, Brad Johnson. He's a professor of psychology in the Department of Leadership, Ethics, and Law at the U.S. Naval Academy. He's also faculty associate at the grad school for Johns Hopkins University, former lieutenant commander in Navy's Medical Services Corps, and he's written extensively on these topics, the topics of mentoring and professional ethics and counseling. In fact, he has 13 books that he's written. So we've got a lot of thought leadership up here, and we believe this will be a great conversation. So, Brad, please take it away.
Thank you so much, Richard. Yeah, appreciate it. Is this mic working okay? Okay. I've been told I have a clinical psychologist voice, so I'll try and talk loudly. I've got about 8 minutes just to plant some flags and say a few things about the data around male allyship, and then we're going to jump right into introducing you to our panelists and move on, and my timekeeper is going to say stop at 8 minutes. So let me just say a few things about this topic. Number one, one of the things that we encounter frequently is men not engaging around allyship efforts because they hear the word gender, they hear the word diversity or inclusion, and they immediately tune out, right? That's a women's issue. And part of the work that we have to do, we find, is to make this a leadership issue and help men understand this is not a women's issue, it's a leadership issue broadly. Why men, you know, often is a legit question that comes up. Why are they so important in this conversation? Boston Consulting Group did a research study not long ago where they went out and asked women across corporate America, is your company making real progress on gender equality? And the number one sort of variable that made the difference whether that was a yes or no was, were men engaged, right? So when women saw men as quite engaged in this, about 90% said, yep, we're making real progress. When men did not seem to be engaged, about 30%. So big difference on how women experience this. We also know we have a disconnect in how men and women see this, right? So Harvard Business Review did a big study again in corporate America, went and asked men in leadership, are you including women in all the important decisions in your company? 90-some percent of men said, yep, we got it. We are, absolutely. Then they went and asked the women in those same companies, 82% said, yeah, not so much. No, I don't feel included in all these important decisions. So we've got the disconnect I think we've got to wrestle with somehow in terms of perception. How about mentoring and sponsoring, right? I'm the co-author of Athena Rising, which is how men can get better at mentoring women. And when we were doing the research for the book, we sort of discovered men are reluctant for a variety of reasons to engage women as sponsors and mentors in the workplace. And for a variety of reasons. Some guys have implicit bias, right? She's nice. I don't see her as leadership material. Or she's a ticking time bomb of maternity, right? Any moment she might have children. And so whether I'm conscious or not of those biases, they affect my willingness to engage. Some men are anxious, right? I know how to have a relationship with a mom or a sister or maybe a spouse, but I don't have a manuscript for how to have a collegial, collaborative, close relationship that's non-sexual with a woman in the workplace. I wasn't equipped that way, so I don't know what to do. When I get anxious, I check out, I disengage. And then comes along Me Too, right? And Me Too is such an important social moment for us, an important conversation. But you're watching the research from Bloomberg and Lean In, 60% of men in corporate America now say they're less comfortable having ordinary conversations with women at work, whether it's lunch or coffee or a mentoring conversation. Men are reporting anxiety. All of us, I think, have got to be willing to push back on the false narratives coming out of Me Too, right? And many of these perpetuated by men. Stranger danger, women are scary, can't talk to them. No, let's go back and hit reset on Me Too. Me Too is just about women asking to come to work and not be assaulted or harassed. It's a super low bar for if you can't get over that bar, you probably shouldn't be employed in the first place. So it means you're a predator or a serial harasser. So let's reset, the narrative there. And my message to men is if you're a bumbling, average guy who sometimes makes mistakes or says the wrong thing, but you've got your heart in the right place, you're making efforts to sort of lean in, you've got probably more risk of getting struck by lightning than having a false claim of harassment. So let's push back on those narratives. How are men motivated to do this work? I think we have to kind of be aware of that. You ask men, why are you doing this male allyship? Why is it important? Some men motivated by personal relationships. Maybe it was my daughter. I began to see what was going on with her. Other guys, very bottom line oriented, right? Show me the business case. Why is this good for me? And other guys are just in it for the social justice piece. This is fair and it's equitable. And those are not mutually exclusive. Sometimes it's all of those things. But I think we do have to have some empathy for where guys are if we're going to connect with them. There are two parts to allyship, at least, and I just want to give a shout out for the fact that, the easy part, honestly, is having good relationships with women at work. Be collaborative, be reciprocal, be friendly, be engaging, be supportive. I think that's the easy part of allyship, and all men should do that. The tough part we're finding is the public part, right? The advocacy, the calling stuff out when a guy says something sexist, advocating for systemic kinds of policies that are good for men and women, whether it's parental leave or something else. Men have a harder time getting over that second hurdle, the real advocacy piece. So we need to help them, I think, with that. Men need to get better in that area. How am I doing? Am I getting close? Good, okay. A couple last things. Two last comments. One, how do we bring men into spaces like this, or should we? I think it's something we got to wrestle with, right? So women's conferences, women's ERGs are sometimes now having a subtrack for men because we realize, these have been safe spaces for women for years and places where women can be together and commiserate and plan gender equality initiatives. Very important. Women have been carrying the emotional labor for this for a long time. And so it's been a space for women. If it's only women having these conversations, we've got a long way to go. I think the latest estimate is 200 years to full pay equity. So we've got to bring guys in somehow. Some conferences are doing things like having tracks, subtracks for guys called things like male champions. Now, the beauty of that is it brings guys in, right? Yes, I'd like to be a champion. So it brings the dudes in. The problem is, you know, understandably, women can roll their eyes at that and say, really? I got to call you a champion just to get you to be interested in equality in the workplace. I think we have to have these humble conversations about how we do this together and how we come to the table. Last thing, and I'm going to wrap up and get to our panelists. I think Dave Smith and I have just finished all our research on a new book on male allyship. And one of the things that really resonated and resounded in our interviews with women was, hey, if you're going to go to work and throw on your male ally cape and pretend to be this gender equity dude at work, you better be doing it at home. You better be doing this work at home first, because it's somewhat disingenuous for men not to be pulling their 50% at home. I think until that happens, things are going to be unequal in the workplace. So if it's only women who need to take more time off for parental leave, if it's only women sneaking off to, you know, do things with kids in the afternoon, if it's only women asking for flex time, we've got a long way to go. If men start doing this, I think we're getting to equity more quickly. I'm getting the stop sign, so I'm going to, okay. So what I'd like to do, I've asked each of the panelists to quickly just introduce themselves to you and maybe do it very briefly, and then we're going to jump right in with one question kind of targeted to each one of them individually, and then we're just going to have a great discussion up here. And we're saving about 15 minutes for Q&A at the end. So, Michael, can you start? Just sure. Quick introduction.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you. Michael Chamberlain is my name. I work at Catalyst, which is a approaching 60-year nonprofit focused on advancing women in the workplace. My place, I suppose, on this stage today is that I was a co-creator of a program called MARC, Men Advocating Real Change. That's probably approaching its 15th year now. So while I have my day job, which I'm sure we'll explore and talk about, my day job of strategic partnerships at Catalyst, I'm constantly working on that MARC program and evolving that and working on a lot of the things that you talked about. So yeah. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Roshana.
Good morning. My name is Roshana Bide. I am the founder and curator of the Corner of the Court Project, and that is a website where women tell positive stories about their careers, their career journeys, their successes, and showcasing also how a male ally has helped contribute to her success, or just a shout out that she wants to acknowledge about the impact that a man has made. And we are about 3.5 years old. It stemmed out of my research for my master's degree, which was on helping men be authentic in the workplace. And it evolved into this movement of women, really accomplished, amazing women that are wanting to step up and proactively reach over to men and say, not only please help us, but let me also share with you how a man has helped me in the past. And so I'm really excited to be here to talk about some of the lessons that we learn and also the psychology behind why I have chosen to take this approach and what a lot of the women and the men are saying. So,
excellent. Tony.
Thank you. So, Tony Colon, I'm a father, I'm a husband, I'm a son, and I work for Cisco, and I'm based out of Chicago, so anyone from Chicago? All right. You always got to do that. There's at least three of us. And so I've been at Cisco for about 6 months. Prior to that, I was at Salesforce for 10 years. And so I am the sponsor of Men for Inclusion at Cisco. And when I was at Salesforce, I led the part of the Office of Equality. So very excited to tell you about my journey and what I've learned.
All right. Thank you. So I'm just going to jump in with some pointed first questions. So Roshana, let me start with you. I've actually got a couple for you. So you've been doing the Corner of the Court Project, kind of calling out examples of men who have kind of gotten allyship right. There are a lot of ways to talk about allyship or engage men. Why have you focused on these positive exemplars?
Yeah, so the whole Corner of the Court Project is really rooted in positive psychology. So I appreciate that you picked up on these are positive exemplars. And One of the insights that I got when I went out to research, again, the positive role that men can play by being authentic in their workplace, by bringing their whole selves to work. And I set out to do this research about four or five years ago. And even for just 4 years ago, it's kind of weird to think back. I live in New York City, and I had to do a research project, and I went to several companies, and many of them laughed, and they said, we don't talk about men in this way, and you don't know what you're talking about, lady. And so it sort of became a mission for me to figure out what is it that we can do to allow men to have authentic ways to be advocates for diversity on terms that men can relate to. So I set out to research and interview men who were deemed really good allies. So they were referred to me. And as I was interviewing the men, a couple of insights came up. The first insight was that very often when I would approach the men and have a one-on-one interview, they weren't able to articulate why they cared or what it was that they were doing. And so for me then to see that they were actually making an impact but had no idea that they were making an impact, that was one insight. Another insight for me was that there were so many women that were referring me to said men to interview. And the excitement that these women would show would be, and it could have been a boss, it could have been a first mentor, it could have been her dad. The way that these women were speaking about the impact that these men had made on their careers, I said, these stories aren't really being told. But at that time, this was just research. And so the website came about. It's called the Corner of the Court Project because it's a tennis metaphor. And it is a bit of, I would say, an homage maybe to my older brother, who was my tennis coach when I was 12. And I had 25 years after one particular incident where I was struggling on the tennis court. My brother had no idea. I was struggling on the tennis court because I was playing a really important match against this boy who I had the biggest crush on. And I knew that this boy liked me. I was 12. And it was the first time that I thought, well, am I supposed to throw the match so that he likes me? Or can I actually win? And it was my brother. My brother had no idea any of this was happening, but I had been trained by my brother as the coach, my coach the whole summer. And when I told him 25 years later that, you know, I showed up to that particular tennis match with your confidence boost in my head, my brother's reaction was, wow, he said, I had no idea I made that impact on you. And so that for me, I thought, wow, there could be a real opportunity to engagement, because I noticed my brother's reaction after I shared that with him. It's, you know, it's one data point, it's a personal data point that validated a lot of the other research, which was when we point out to the men the good things that they're doing, they tend to do it more and they feel invited into the conversation. So that's what the website is, and that's why we look at the positive behaviors.
Yeah, thank you. Let me go to you, Michael. Sure. You have, with Catalyst, you've been doing this work around male allyship for years. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how Me Too and Time's Up have changed the workplace in your view, and then how has it affected the work you're trying to do around bringing allies in?
Sure. So I would say that there were, you know, the research for that backed the MARC program has probably been in development for about 15 years now. So we set out to understand, because we saw, as you were describing, we saw some good men out there doing some pretty good things and open about their sponsorship of women and kind of breaking ranks with other men and kind of fighting for fairness and equality. And we were like, what can we do to organizational ecosystems that enable more men to follow that path? And so we sought out, as all the researchers do, to understand the barriers and really kind of mitigate those while building up opportunities to show more role modelship. What we found, of course, is that there was things like fear, ignorance, apathy, and zero-sum thinking. Those are the basic kind of four quadrants of what mitigated men from doing this stuff. My observation with the Me Too experience has been that it has exaggerated all of those things. And there's a lot of noise around it, and there's important noise. The good part about the Me Too movement, aside from most of the obvious, but the good part about it for the work that we do around MARC and engaging men is that it has also amplified the interest of men in this sense of fairness. That was the one reason we've seen consistently for over a decade now about why men do kind of cross the line and you know, become better advocates of equality in the workplace is this sense of fairness. When they see things happening that are unfair, they want to fix it. So play to that piece is the kind of philosophy of Mark. And so with the Me Too movement, I've seen a really big amplification of the conversation. Men understand a little bit more their part in this. They're intellectually curious, and that has expanded. And so I think the conversations have all been, the amplification and opportunity of the conversations have all been great. How the Mark community specifically is evolving to kind of meet all of this, where it is a piece that has differentiated the Mark program to what you were talking about earlier, is it's always been a place for men. It's been a place for men to be informed by women, to hear the voices of women, but it's a place for men to converse with one another, which is a piece of the success, is men have to talk about this. They have to interrupt each other and be better upstanders publicly. They have to break the ranks that I was suggesting, and they have to share what works, both in the workplace and at home. And so the Mark program has been extraordinarily successful because there's been a community of men learning from and with one another, and that exists. And we see thousands of men joining that community all of the time because whether or not they need a quote-unquote safe space to dialogue, they need a place to dialogue. So we give them one of those, and that's it. So I think that we're evolving the way that that works, using new technologies to enable the conversations to happen more globally and be protected while also being storytelling platforms, et cetera. So there's some really cool technologies that we're building with partners, as well as borrowing from those that do it well, the media, opportunities like this, et cetera. So I think the evolution is the openness of conversation and the voices that are heard there. My last piece on this, though, I think the important, where my mind is constantly focused is, you know, we have great copywriters out there. There's lots of consumable information out there. It's easy to copy. And so authenticity is going to be a really big piece. Leaders will be able to train themselves to say all the right things on all the right stages, and then that completely dismantles in behavior. So I think that the authenticity piece, the integrity piece, really putting people through a commitment training, as to what this really means, is the next phase of this, of the pilgrimage, I call it, but the journey. Yeah. Ahead is the authenticity I don't think will be tolerated, and it shouldn't be. So how do we get to where we need to be together is the next phase for us.
All right, thank you. Tony, the Chicago guy, got a question for you. So you have been doing a lot of this work to kind of drive, you know, change in men in your space. How have you been working to get guys actually to step up and become more engaged in allyship?
Yeah, so thank you all for being here. This is an amazing opportunity. And, you know, one thing I've learned, I always tell my story, and I think everyone wants to hear your story. And you make it authentic, you make it real. There's a lot of folks who sign up for men for inclusion programs or ally programs that they do it because I feel like they think it's a check-the-box activity. I tend to get a negative or allergic reaction when I hear men who feel that this is an opportunity for them to show their leadership that I do care about this thing. And the biggest challenge that when they do a check-the-box activity, they just don't show up. Or they'll show up, but they don't always speak up. And so for me, it's always about action and sort of have an action bias. And for me, the pivot for me happened when I was always a champion for Latinos. I'm Hispanic. And what I realized is we always had our events and we only included ourselves. So we would speak Spanish. We would only have events related to that. And then I started talking to other resource groups and realized we are not being inclusive, right? And you would have the same with the African-American community, the same thing with the LGBTQ community. And we started combining forces. And what was interesting to me is a man, a white man, stood up and he goes, "Where's the messed up white man group?"
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, I don't think that exists, but what if we created a men for inclusion group?" And this predated me at Cisco, but I was really excited to hear at Cisco we do have that. And the other thing that's been impactful is that it's not just me who sponsors it, it's a female leader within the company, another executive. So her and I go to these events. I mean, we were at, you know, Grace Hopper, we're here, We're at Better Man Conference. We're at ELC. This is my fifth conference in 3 weeks. So it's been an amazing sort of mini tour of just really trying to find the allyship. And, you know, you sort of, is ally even the right word? And, you know, some people say, like, ally could, you know, it's more rally than ally. And so for me, it's been really impactful just to share my own experience of I've been in tech my entire life, and men have to do something. We're, you know, 70% of tech is men, if not more, especially at senior levels. You're starting to get to single percentage points. And so we've got to do something to change it.
Yeah, excellent.
Thank you, Tony. Mm-hmm. One more, thank you. One more targeted question, and then we're just going to have them interact with each other. But Roshana, with all of your corner of the court stuff and looking at these exemplars, from all of that wisdom, is there a profile of a great male ally? We have a lot of people out here looking for allies. So can you distill it to, you know, what are the traits or characteristics?
No, I can't. That's what I set out to research. And the MARC movement, again, I mentioned like 4 or 5 years ago, it was really difficult for me to find resources to answer exactly this question. And MARC was a really great place for me to do that. So thank you for all that you did to launch the work and the research. And no, still to be determined. So I, one of the things I like to do from the website is, the website is a celebration of relationships. It's a celebration of stories and men who, again, are stepping up to do things that they might not have even realized were out of the ordinary or were making an impact. So I try to answer this question because I had a gentleman, a friend of mine, he had said, oh, you know, Roshana, the stories are great, and he is very supportive. And he said, but I still don't know what I need to do. He said, I am a dude. Just break it down. Tell me in like 6 steps what it needs to be. So I have endeavored to do that. The reason that that's been, so there's quite a few things. I will answer your question with some examples. But one of the things that I just want to underscore is that there's, in leadership and in the workplace, there are, you know, you impart skills to people or you impart motivation, or people are successful because they're skilled at something and or they're motivated or they have the confidence to do it. And so what the men are often asking for is the skills. And what our website is looking to do and our movement is looking to do is to build confidence and then turn that into motivation. So we really are taking an emotional psychology relationship-based approach to building confidence. So even if there's one guy who reads that a woman said that her, in my case, older brother or her first boss made that impact, he can say, oh, well, I can do that too, or wow, I might have done that as well. So it allows for the reflection. Some of the good behaviors, though, are leadership behaviors. So understanding networks, organizational networks, opening up the power of your network to other people, to women, to be able to have opportunities or just make connections to advance their careers. I have a really compelling story from the first woman to coach in the NFL. I really like this one because it's a sports story. We're a sports metaphor. We don't only look at women and men in sports. But her story was really great. Her name is Jen Welter. She wrote about Bruce Arians, the first, the head coach of the Cardinals at the time. And what he did was he went into the locker room and discussed and talked with, almost like what your MARC network, and also with the network you were talking about, what impact might this have? And it was basically just doing what leaders do when they initiate change, which is getting champions or getting agents, getting buy-in. And so really a lot of those behaviors, Brad, and all of you, are good leadership behaviors. So what I like to do is add the gender piece of it to say, you know what the behavior is, so what's motivating you to do it? Is it because you have a relationship with this person? Because we all probably are really amazing allies or mentors to people at work, but we're not allies or mentors to everybody at work. So that's also something for us to say, who is it that we are also reaching out and sponsoring and helping?
Yeah, excellent. So let's get very tactical for a minute. So we have a big group of women here, and if a woman is sitting in the audience right now thinking, there just aren't guys in my workplace right now, men that I work with that feel like they meet the criteria for ally based on the conversation so far, are there things I can do to draw that out or start engaging men who might get it in some ways? Any thoughts about that, best practices?
I don't know. Well, it's to your point. I wish there was a man book, right? there's not. I think the thing that has worked for me is there are programs. So we've started something called the Multiplier Effect. And essentially, the thing is, and you shared it with Bruce Arians, like, the first thing, and again, it's 70% men, and then they're primarily white men at the top. And so what you don't want to do is then have another sort of challenge, which it's only white women that they bring to the table. So I think this is just one of those things where how do you explicitly state there's the gender bias and then there's the racial bias where they'll associate because their daughter or their mother, and that's who they're used to. And so I think it's very interesting sort of changing and thinking the dynamic of making it very explicit. I mean, I'll give a quick story. I was at the ELC conference, which is an African-American conference that's held in Washington, D.C., and I didn't know the rules. And so I showed up to the room, and I was the only person that wasn't black. And someone asked me, what are you doing here? And I said, I want to know what it's like to be the only. And so one of the things that was very powerful is sharing that story with people at Cisco, saying, here's what it's like and how it felt to me. And then here, imagine what the individuals feel like every day at work. And so being vocal and being very visible with that has really changed the game where they say, okay, well, Tony, tell me, where's your network? Who is an ally? What could I learn more from? I think it is not always incumbent on the individual. It's incumbent on the leadership to really force that change because, again, it's really hard to raise your hand sometimes and sort of say, will you be my sponsor? I don't think anyone's going to say no. But it goes back to where they show up.
Yeah, I find that question very difficult. I find that question difficult because for years we've asked women what they can do to enable this stuff, right? And it gets into the fix the women space. And we don't want to do that, yet we also don't want to say that women have no role in this, that there isn't something there for them to both learn and contribute. That would be the absolute wrong message too. So I think that there's a lot of things in the corporate space that need to happen concurrently, right? We need to divide and conquer, tackle like certain, especially the problematic areas. And then we need to work more holistically on inclusion and things like psychological safety and the team dynamics that can be enabled in the corporate culture so that, because 21st century leadership is not going to look like mentoring and allyship and sponsorship in the way that we know it now, which is very gender-based, right? And men have privilege, women do not, so men please do all these things and women, but, you know, that isn't going to work because in the gender dialogue won't be on a binary. It's a very evolving space where the corporate environment has a unique set of circumstances where we could create there first versus all these other economies. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself even with that. I like to say that people should behave like everybody's watching you because they are. You know, so for the women in the room today, you're not at work. People know you're missing. Like, they knew you went somewhere. And so tomorrow, let's say you go back to work, it's a different kind of conversation opportunity. You can say, well, this is where I was, and there was some men on stage, and there were some women on stage, and they said some things. And that really is about the conversation. And it sparks people's intellectual curiosity, and the spark is what we need. And then we need to make it obvious where resources are. And so there's, you know, these great things happening in the corporate space. Catalyst.org is a wonderful space to not only find, like, the academic stuff, but then the consumable, like how to flip the script, how to use different words. Like, so you have to follow your intellectual curiosity and find resources and then share them with one another. And what I hope is also happening in the partnership space is that folks like us, like all these faces have become extraordinarily familiar to me, which is awesome. We're moving more into a collective so that we're doing things with greater consistency and that we're not duplicating or competing and so that the resources become more obvious, right? And I think organizations can do a better job pointing to folks like Catalyst and folks like, you know, the rest of the group on the stage to say, they're all working together, and we can do a better job of partnering with one another to make that happen as well. So the partnership is key. Upstanders, be better upstanders. We don't need bystanders or armchair allies. We need people actively interrupting this and personalizing it and being vocal. And then I think being a really good role model in your individual sphere of influence is what we all can commit to doing today, and then, mm-hmm. you know, helping corporations expand on that is what we need to focus on.
Let me follow up on something, Tony. Tony, you introduced the intersectionality piece, talking about women of color, and I wonder, Roshan or Michael, thoughts about that. How do we make sure that women of color who already have significantly more hurdles in terms of becoming recipients of some of these initiatives and programs, how do we make sure they get the full advantage of male ally initiatives?
So I am willingly. So you looked at me. I'm obviously a woman of color, and it was. If you hadn't asked the question, I probably would have acknowledged and noticed that I am a woman of color doing this work, in large part on behalf of white men. And I've had white men, I used to live in Chicago, and so I would bro out with them, we'd go to Cubs games. Like, I've had a lot of white men that were really, really amazing champions for me. And as I was doing the research, I realized that I have a lot of men of color that are equally great champions for me. And even from the men as allies topic, it sort of felt like the default was to white men. So I even had to check my own bias and my own experiences on that. As a woman of color, I actually think that there's a story I'm going to share, and it's a story about myself, but it's also a story about allyship, and it has to do with the shoes I'm wearing. So I had no idea you were going to ask this question when I packed to come here. And the shoes I'm wearing, if you can't see them, they're just caramel pumps. Being a woman of color, when I look for a shade of neutral shoes, they are often much lighter than my skin tone. And the shoes that I've bought, it's the first time when I wore them, I even walked through Madison Square Park kind of feeling completely different, almost feeling like I was seen, like I was walking in shoes that were made for me. And when I talked to the woman who started the brand, interestingly, the brand is called Ally Shoes. So right there, I said, okay, this is really interesting. And her mission, her name is Samantha, her mission is to make shoes every woman's ally. For women, many of us know, I don't want to overgeneralize, but many women know about the fairy tales. There's a reason why shoes are so important in fairy tales. Well, she really wanted the shoe to be something that was for the modern contemporary woman to feel like she can move around in. She's Asian, and she has her leadership team, so it's her company, and she has a leadership team of two other women and an advisor who is male. And she went out, and she was a management consultant. She went out to him, and she knew that he came from Nike, and she said, I'm an outsider to the footwear industry. What do I need to do? And he linked her up with her two, now her other leadership team members. And it's a podiatric surgeon and a designer. And he specifically knew that she needed the podiatric surgeon because she wanted to design a great shoe, but he also knew she needed a designer because he himself said, I don't know what it's like to wear high heels. I don't know the problem that you're trying to solve, so let me link you up with some amazing people who can help you solve the problem. And it turned out that now that her team is herself, she's Asian, she has a black, one of the podiatric surgeon, and the designer is Latina. And the three of them, when they looked to, so back to the story of how this shoe ended up on my foot with like tears in my eyes that, wow, I finally feel seen, it was because this male ally recognized that where his expertise, shortcoming in expertise, and also that he was a man, he offered his network to create a shoe. And so now they, when the three of them got together, the women, they said, oh gosh, like nude, what does nude even mean? And so I think it's, and again, they're called Ally Shoes. I don't want to pitch the shoe, but I can't stress enough that there's magic that happens when people acknowledge just where there might be gaps and just proactively look to fix them. And so I appreciate you asking the question.
Let me ask and anyone chime in on this one, but in all of your work around male allyship, you've been doing this for a long time, Is there one thing that kind of percolates to the top in terms of maybe being the biggest surprise, or, you know, the thing that, you know, maybe you didn't expect, but you keep coming back to and kind of finding this about the male ally space or about men wading into this? Is there something, an epiphany, something that kind of strikes you?
I can start. So I think the epiphany for me has always been people look at it as a one-month rotational thing. Yeah. And so I sort of said, this is not a, you know, this is a journey. It's a marathon, not whatever, you know, metaphor you want to use. But I think folks look at, hey, I'll be the sponsor. I'm going to be the sponsor. I'll have my name on face on this sponsorship program. And it's for a year. And I'm like, that's kind of interesting because I don't look at this as a one-year program. I look at this as a lifelong journey. I mean, you look in tech, just did a statistic that it was like 85 million shortage in the next, you know, 10 years of people. What an opportunity to start closing some of that gap with new talent. And the challenge with tech is we always go to the same universities, the same schools, and we still have that bias of the schools that we all went to. And instead of going to the community college, instead of going to places where people may not have the means to afford a four-year university. And I think that has to change. And there's not enough people with that diverse. I mean, you read job descriptions, they still talk about the four-year degree and master degree preferred. Like, not everyone can afford that. So you're already filtering out many people. And I think that's been the surprising, like, as businesses, we keep talking about it, but there's still sort of the fundamental sort of HR-related things that we still just go with a templated approach to stuff. And obviously, there's progressive companies that are coming on board that are changing it, but it's the old guard that just needs a change.
Yeah, I mean, for me, and this is going to sound extraordinarily naive, but I think the disinterest in worst-case scenarios and or the interest and lack of follow-up in disruption. I think that we need a dynamic new way to look at things. We need to disrupt these systems that have privileged few and disadvantaged others. But the systems that most of us are talking about are extraordinarily profitable. And they're like, we're okay being the best of the worst, really? That seems like a miss at best, but I understand it too, so I wanted to acknowledge the naivete, right? And being able to say something like that is in of itself extraordinarily privileged. But I think that we need to think about disruption differently. We need to stop admiring monoliths, you know, to your point about people of color and differences of onlyness. Like, you know, there's intersectionality in all of us, and it's extraordinarily important to understand that and take it into our comprehension as leaders, you know? I think the way to do it, though, given the constraints that I'm acknowledging, is to look broadly, deeply, and often. To challenge yourself in each and every circumstance, why am I looking in the mirror? Like, you know, I too find myself on a circuit of speaking opportunities, which I love. It's highly distracting to my day job, but I love doing it because the storytelling there is so impactful. And, you know, I met a gentleman who was in his early 30s at a conference recently and worked for Boeing. So this was surprising to me, the connection there, who had flown for the very first time coming to this event. And I was like, how is it possible? But, right? And my instinct is to imagine a lot of things about that guy and to complete his journey and to have lots of thoughts about it. But instead, I was like, I can be really curious about this and understand what he's going back to differently and empower him with at least some of what I've got to have that different conversation that I was talking about earlier. And so we have to find disruption in our own small pockets, I suppose, while organizations are working, as we've heard, on some really fascinating programs that truly are finding disruption in their own pockets. But I think that waiting around, admiring the possibilities, talking about what could be done and should be done, et cetera, it can be done. Like, we all have to do it. And so the commitment starts with each and every one of us. And I think that's where corporations are beginning to recognize that people will take to the streets if this doesn't happen, yeah. You know, and that there's a powerful opportunity to be had, should we choose to have it, and to be missed if we choose to ignore it. You know, this is where innovation lies now, not in the way that we've done things for decades. And so I think each one of us has a voice. We have to use it. So we were talking about silence and and things like that. So I just hope that people will walk away today just being curious and saying, let's have a different conversation about this and see where that goes.
Mm-hmm. If I can add some surprising insights, I have three. One is that I was very surprised from the stories to find out that the men who are featured are so touched and so humbled. And really, they aren't. It's the opposite of the research that we sometimes read about men, that they are braggarts, and that they, when there's a one-to-one acknowledgement that's personal, it really makes an impact. So that was one insight around the humility that the men are showing that are featured. The second insight is around the impact on women, because. Even though, and we talked about this earlier in the panel, even though it does feel like we as the women in the corner of the court were taking on the burden of, you know, writing a story just to acknowledge the men, something cool is happening because the women on the website are finding each other and they're supporting each other in their endeavors. And it's also making me more in tune to what else we can do to support women. And one thing that was the third thing that I'll mention, so that was the second insight, is that even though it's women with men, it's an ecosystem that works together. And so the more we talk about and share the stories, the more I'm seeing this ecosystem connect. And so then the third insight is it's just on me personally. And I really appreciate that I can be on this panel with the corporate side and the academic research side and the thought leader to be the one kind of who's looking at the individual connections and what my role is. And last week at work, it was a very, very, very difficult couple of weeks. And I shared in a WhatsApp with a friend of mine, white male friend from who lives abroad. And I told him what happened. So he left a voice message back and I was listening to it. And he's relating, when this happened to me, da 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 da. And my first instinct was to be like, yeah, dude, I know this. Like, yeah. I get it. I don't need you to answer my problem. I just need support. But he got to the support part at the end, and he said, and I wish I were there. I would give you a big hug. Like, everything's going to be fine. So he got there, but also in him processing what he had experienced, it allowed us now to even strategize about things that we didn't even know we would strategize about for his career and mine. So me being able to catch myself and suspend writing him off as, I hate this word, a mansplainer, really, I think, was a lesson for me. So I would encourage, to your question around the surprising insights, by being really conscious of this, I feel like we are able to open ourselves up to lots of innovation, to use your word, that we might have even, it's out there, we just haven't really been able to grasp it with each other yet.
Yeah. Turn it back over.
Oh, that was it?
Yeah, time flies.
So amazing insights, and listen, what a great panel. We've been very fortunate to have them share their insights. Yes, please give them a hand. And for those of you that were taking notes, you probably heard a lot of reference to MARC, this acronym. Again, if you want to look that up on the Catalyst website, it's Men Advocating Real Change, or on the MARC.org. For Dell, we have a similar story to tell. Ours is called Mini Advocating Real Change, this idea that we all play a role and need to make a commitment around building inclusive workplaces where everyone can thrive. So let me ask for one final thought from each of our panelists here. What is one top strategy that you would recommend for the audience around, you know, identifying and leveraging male allies in your ecosphere? And then we'll open it up for questions from the audience. So shall we start with you, Tony?
Sure. So at one of the conferences I spoke with a couple of weeks ago, I just had a poll and asked the question, how many have a Men for Inclusion or MARC program in their organizations? Surprisingly enough, out of 20 different large companies, only one company raised their hand. So I think for me, it's being and actually saying we need to do this, because I think we all sort of are allied with each other here. But it's interesting that most companies don't even see it. So I think if you want to be the voice and the champion or find allies within your organization and actually start these EROs, I don't think anyone's going to say no.
Even as a woman?
Yeah, so the MFI at Cisco was started by a woman. And she found male allies to join her.
Good. Thank you.
I think the one practical takeaway would be journaling and reflecting. That's been the biggest thing for me. I would never have discovered that story about Evan and being 12 and the impact and any of this if I hadn't been really writing thoughtfully about my own self. So I would invite us to do that. That's been helpful for me.
Great. Michael?
I would repeat something I was sharing earlier about individual sphere of influence. I mean, I think I have the privilege of working at Catalyst for 15 years now, and it's been around for 60 years. The needle is not moving. There's billions of dollars being spent every year on great events like this, but also programs within organizations, and none of them are bad. Extremely well-intended, by the way. And I think they're very informative, but they're inefficient. They're insufficient, rather, is the word. Because what's lacking is a corporate culture that enables psychological safety and trust because they're focused on profitability. And right now, those things live in conflict for the most part. And so I think so how does that change happen? It happens concurrently with the programs that we've been talking about and investing in those and making sure that everybody has a space, be that safe, be that allyship space, be that a conversation with sponsors and others, but that there's also communication happening and being enabled at every level for people to just talk and speak differently and attain the psychological safety that's necessary to have true breakthrough conversations and be like, I never saw that happening until I experienced and got there. Most people won't. But we can set up the right systems that enable those outcomes more often than what we're doing now. And I just think that requires people's voices and saying, I need something that I'm not getting, talking to one another about it, talking to their managers about it. That isn't a demand per se. It's just a conversation that can, I hope, flow with the popularity of all of this into a space where it's happening in a more, I guess, robust and cohesive space versus program after program after program.
Yeah. Great. Brad, would you like to get some final
one
thoughts?
One quick takeaway, I think, for me today was listening to Roshana say over and over again, the guys that, you know, she heard stories about were always surprised, you know. There's this humility. And if I were looking for men to be kind of allies, I would look for these humble guys. So if a guy approaches you and says, I'm your ally, I would run because I think he's missing that humility. I think you're an ally when someone else calls you an ally. I don't think you get to self-identify.
Yeah. Very good. Well, we know there's probably some really good questions in the audience as well, so please, we welcome you now to approach the mic here, if you will, and feel free to direct questions to our panelists.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Francesca. I work for the Federal Department, Department of Defense. So yes. Thank you, sir, for your service.
Yeah,
so quick question. The most powerful and impactful person in my career was a white male, former colonel. Five things that we could even go through the whole story, five different things that he did to grow my career. And you talked about how do we create a safe space for men to be joining the conversation, including them through fairness, the topic of fairness, and also disrupting the conversation. How do we do that in a society that is constantly bashing the male? How do we invite individuals in when they perhaps might be saying, but hold on, everybody around me is saying I'm a male, get out of the way, get away from 20 years and leave the women in charge, right? We just heard that this morning. So how do we disrupt the conversation to say you are also part of the conversation? We need all of us included in this.
I can answer that because, and I would... This is exactly what Corner of the Court is trying to do, is to send that message, not just of positivity, it's rooted in positive psychology, but around the fact that we're an evolved species. We don't need to shame others in order to be successful ourselves. However, in human psychology, sometimes that the adversarial is necessary in order to make change. So I think Me Too was that. And Me Too was very necessary. And our project was founded before Me Too. And during Me Too, we sort of went quiet a little bit because it was time to be respectful of that. Now, I do feel that the sentiment that you expressed is starting to be more and more shared. I don't have an answer except the website is what we're trying to do, is our movement. But I also appreciate the fact that there are people here who are showing up to talk about this. And I'll let the other panelists chime in to answer your question. And then I have one more thing based on what you
said. I feel compelled to add to this just a bit. I don't think that you have the answer, but you have an answer, right? So I think that that needs to be validated. Nobody has a complete picture of all of this. So I love the perspective that was just shared about men bashing. I think that we've spent a whole lot of time celebrating men, quite frankly. But that doesn't mean I'm more right. It's a complementary perspective. And so I think that we should feel compelled to voice what we feel compassionate about, what we feel smart about, perhaps we feel educated about, because wrong is going to look different too. You know, we need to unbake failure. The only way that we're going to get anywhere is if we stop aiming for perfection and silver bullet. There is absolutely no playbook for this. It's just about having different conversations and being curious with one another and saying, well, what worked for you? You know, no system is going to create a perfect pathway for that, and we should celebrate the attempt versus punishing the failures so much, unless they're egregious, by the way, punish those.
Well, and the downstream effects, because when we talk about, oh, well, men, come on, why after Me Too are you so unwilling to, like, don't be afraid? Well, that's also shaming. Like, it's continuing the same thing. And so that's another thing, I think, if we can just be conscious of downstream effects of, and also the fact that we are in with social media, anything can, we can, that's why our project uses social media so heavily to be able to harness the power of crowds. So we can use that to our advantage if we choose.
And can I just also add, remember there's this ally continuum. You have a small group of guys on the far end. They are ready to sit down and talk to each other about their privilege, about toxic masculinity. They're ready. That's a small group. Most guys, when you say, we start off a conversation with toxic masculinity, you've lost them. And so you just got to have empathy, you know, for that continuum. And men are in different places there, I think.
A great point. Thank you for that question. Let's go to the next one, please.
Hi, my name is Liana. I run a women's resource group at Arm, which is a technology company and actually a new Catalyst partner. Mm-hmm. My question was around, so we have a lot of men who are great allies. We also have a lot of men who either disinterested or, you know, even are saying things like, why is the company always pushing this D&I agenda? You know, we're sick of hearing about it. And a lot of those men are, since we're an engineering company, in really significant roles for technical leadership that could have a huge impact on women's careers. So with these men that don't have, you know, positive attitudes towards D&I, that could, if they did, make a huge impact, how can we influence them? How can we make a difference there?
Yeah, good question.
Everyone looks at me. I hear you. I mean, we did a very large talent. We're a global company, as you are, and it's just, it's a challenge because then you'd multicultural facets of just how it works in some countries. And so I literally had a group of women stand up and say, my boss goes, I can't believe you're going to another woman's event. And I was shocked. And then I realized, okay, that's probably more common than not. And then ultimately it's that, you know, the answer we gave was that's poor leadership. That's no longer, we can't control what happens outside of our four walls, but we can control what happens inside of our four walls. And that behavior just is not allowed in our company or our culture. And I think the other big thing for us was giving them the practices of what they can and cannot do as an individual, which is why, like, the MFI program talks a lot about various aspects of being a man within Cisco. You know, there's a lot of mental health challenges for men. Right, it's the highest suicide rates among men, right? So I think taking all of these factors, and also it's not okay to say that, right? And I think a lot of people feel empowered to say that. I think that's been a big challenge that I found in tech in general, and it's obviously in the US, but it's even more pervasive outside of the US, where people just feel it's okay to not allow someone to do something or not give them a promotion because they're always at a woman's event. And so I think, you know, that has to change, and then there has to be bold steps to stop that behavior.
Thank you. Okay, great. Let's. I think we have time for one more question.
It's not. Hi, my name's Katie. It's not necessarily a question. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting. So inclusive diversity is kind of what the topic is, right? I think it's ironic that we're here. Justice Ginsburg, before she was Justice Ginsburg, when she was writing opinions for the ACLU, her lead argument was actually based on a man, right, who was taking care of his mother and couldn't get reparations from the IRS as a tax exemption to claim the care for his mother as a live-in homemaker because he was a man. And the IRS considered that to be woman's work, right? So, and that's how we get eligibility law in the United States for equal pay for women in minority status, those underrepresented under the law. And that's what you're talking about, correct? And you don't want to be identified as siding too much with a privileged status of being male and being white, right?
Yeah.
So women and those underserved minority classes, it'll take 200 years to have equal pay in the United States and around the world. When smaller countries in Europe don't seem to have a problem with it, and their gross national product rivals that of the United States. The United States has no excuse not to pay women equally.
Yeah.
It has no excuse for the wealthiest country in the world. So there really is no excuse for business leaders in the United States to not pay women and minority women, so those over 40, those in the LGBTQI community, and those of color equally for a job done. There is no excuse. And it's been law since the 60s.
It's a great
point.
And
separate but equal is not equal. And it never has been.
Great. Yeah, we thank you. Thank you for sharing that. It's absolutely correct.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, one I know I've learned from, and hopefully you have as well. I really want to say thank you to our panelists once again, and if we can give them one last round of applause.
Thank you.
Thank you, and have a wonderful rest of the conference. Thank you.
Thank you.